OWC Radio number 50 with Peter Cohen to discuss the Apple event. This is OWC Radio number 50. That's right, this is the 50th issue and perfect issue to geek out about Apple because yesterday, as we record this, Apple had their big September 2015 event. And of course, if you're listening to this, you're an Apple person, you know exactly what was announced, but I still want to talk about it. And I brought in our returning champion, Peter Cohen. Hello, Peter.
Hey, how you doing, Tim?
Good. Before we get into this, I had you back on episode number 35, so 15 episodes ago. And towards the end of that episode, one of the things that we talked about, and I got a lot of feedback, and all positive, by the way, was about your bariatric surgery. So I just wanted to catch up real quick before we get into this Apple stuff and ask you, how are you doing? What's been the result of it since, 35 episodes ago?
Or 15 episodes 15 ago?
15 episodes ago, yeah, sorry.
We don't do math. That's why we use computers.
That's why I have a calculator.
Exactly. We get into computers so we don't have to do arithmetic anymore. Anyway, thank you very much for asking, Tim, and thank you everyone who responded. It means the world to me. It really does. I am doing great. So far, since my bariatric surgery last November, I've lost about 100 pounds,
wow.
A little more than 100 pounds. I've gone down my waist size is now the same as it was when I was about 15 or 16 years old. Now, I don't expect to stay at this weight forever. I'm probably going to gain a little bit back before all is said and done. But my doctor tells me that through the course of the surgery that I have, which is called a procedure called Roux-en-Y, it's sort of the classic gastric bypass, I can expect to continue to lose weight for 18 months after the surgery. And then I'll probably put about 20 pounds or so back on. So, I'm spending a lot of money at Goodwill and Savers to extend my clothing budget.
Yeah, a lot of transitional clothing, huh?
Right, a lot of clothing that people don't want or need anymore. So, hey, $5 jeans, it's great. And, over Labor Day weekend, Savers had a 50% off deal for anybody with a Savers Club card. So I bought a brand new wardrobe for about $47. I love stretching the budget. But yeah, it's a lot of fun. I really enjoy cooking. So I'm always trying to find new ways to enjoy some of the food that I loved and find substitutes for foods that I can't have.
Because this isn't just a surgery to cure all your problems. This is also a lifestyle change on your part as well.
It sure is. It sure is. And I think that anybody who thinks about having this surgery should look at programs that sort of adopt a holistic view towards the patient. So not just somebody who's going to cut into your tummy and make it smaller, but somebody who's going to help you understand your relationship to food and help you improve that, because that was a big part of it for me.
Well, congratulations on the successful surgery, your lifestyle change. You're an inspiration, and I'm glad you're doing well.
Thank you so much, Tim. That really means a lot to me.
So let's start in reverse order from this Apple event, and that means we're going to start with the new iPhones.
Woo!
iPhone 6S, iPhone 6S Plus. When you look at them, Peter, they're not a whole lot different other than this rose-colored thing, which I don't want, but I'm sure some people do. They don't look a whole lot different, but as Apple likes to say in their new commercial for this phone, everything inside is different. It's completely a different phone.
It absolutely is. It may look the same. It actually isn't exactly the same. In fact, the iPhone 6 and 6S and 6 Plus are actually a little bit thicker than their predecessors. So they're the same height, the same width. It's the depth that's actually been increased a little bit, and that's we think to strengthen the phone a little bit, so we don't get any more bending problems like we did with a small number of 6 Pluses back last September. So everything inside is different, from the silicon that's being used. The processor is much faster, more LTE coverage than ever before. This is really good news for customers like me who are T-Mobile users, because T-Mobile's been doing an LTE band 12 rollout. It's a 700 megahertz band across the country in as many markets as they can. And this really improves their coverage indoors and in rural areas, which is, are the 2 weak spots of T-Mobile's coverage right now. So
it's the weak spot to a lot. AT&T has the same problems. I can go 15 miles from my house and get almost no reception. So it's going to be a problem for a long time until these new technologies kind of catch up with it.
That's true. So I'm excited about that. But more than anything, the thing that really fascinates me is 3D touch, because this is something that we got kind of a sneak preview on earlier this year on the Macintosh when Apple rolled out the new MacBook, the gorgeous new MacBook, and refreshed the MacBook Air. They introduced the Force Touch trackpad. Which enables you to do really cool things where it's supported, like, for example, highlight a word and then you just push on the trackpad to get the definition of the word. It's something that I really like doing as a wordsmith, as somebody who uses language all the time. I want to make sure that I use it correctly and appropriately. Or, you know, I'll read somebody else's writing and not understand what they're saying, and it makes it a lot easier for me to do that. This Force Touch element already gave us this sort of sense of 3D touch that Apple was going for, where the touching the trackpad, pushing your button or pushing your finger into the trackpad, introduces a new layer of information and a new way of interacting with the user interface that you're already so familiar with. 3D touch is being adapted in exactly that way in iOS 9 on the iPhone 6S and 6 Plus. It's not an interface feature that you're going to get on older phones because they lack the haptic engine or taptic engine, as Apple likes to call it, that is in the iPhone 6S and 6S Plus. So that is a very exciting interface improvement. One thing that I'm kind of scratching my head about that I want to see and that I'm waiting for more feedback on is how this 3D touch element is going to interface for people who use Apple's accessibility technology in iOS, because that is so important for Apple's many customers who may have disabilities or may need some help and assistance in using their devices. So be very interesting to see how Apple has adapted this technology for accessibility. But otherwise, I'm really, really excited about the new phones.
The new thing, at least to me, is the new camera and the sensor technology that they built into the new iPhone 6 and 6 Plus. I think Apple's hidden killer feature that sold the iPhone to a lot of people initially was the camera, because it was so much better than the cameras that you were getting in any other phone at the time. And they keep iterating this phone with every single version, new version of the iPhone. It just keeps getting better and better and better. They really focused on that a lot this year. Of course, I think they do every year with each new iPhone. But this new camera, Peter, looks awesome to me.
The new camera is fantastic. The only thing that scares me a little bit is that Apple left a 16 gigabyte base model I understand it perfectly, and that is because they want to upsell people to spend $100 more on the 64 gig model. But unfortunately, a lot of people who buy these devices, and I mean there are a lot of people who buy these devices, aren't necessarily up on all the latest technology in the same way that many of our listeners are, and may not understand how limiting that 16 gigabytes is going to be when they start putting in 4K videos or high-res 12 megapixel images into their phone. They're going to run out of space really quickly, and they're going to get frustrated. And Apple's 5 gigabytes of free storage in iCloud doesn't give them a lot of room to move. You know, Apple is a little parcimonious here. I think that if the 16 gigabyte base model is going to be around for a long time, Apple should be a little more generous with us on the free iCloud storage to give people a more effective way of offloading the content that they produce on these wonderful devices.
4K video.
4K video. I mean, 4K video. 4K video on a phone that slips into your breast pocket. Think about that for a second. Apple isn't the first one to do it either. Let's not deceive ourselves. Apple is not a groundbreaker here when it comes to 4K video on a phone. But you know, when Apple does it, it's better.
Yeah, absolutely. And I like the pictures. There's an option when you take a picture, it actually records a little bit before and a little bit after. So it's a regular photo that you're taking with the new iPhone, but it gives this kind of a Harry Potter motion to the photo, sound and motion.
Live Photo is what it's called, yeah. And it's a really clever idea. If I understand what Phil Schiller told us yesterday during the Apple presentation, during the Apple event, what happens is that your phone records a second and a half of motion before and a second and a half of motion afterwards, but he's very careful not to call it video. He explains that this is actually part of the photograph. It's actually part of the image itself. So you don't need a special video player to be able to use it. This is just something to give your phones a little bit or your photos a little bit more life and a little bit more vibrancy and help put them in context. And let's face it, when we're recording videos of our kids or special events with our families or even when we're out in nature trying to record a special moment, let's say at the beach or running with the dog, those sort of things hit an emotional resonance with us in a way that very few other things do.
Absolutely.
So I think it's really special that Apple recognizes this and is trying to take advantage of it by introducing new technology like this.
It's really, really cool. Live Photos is one of the things that kind of makes me want to trade in this iPhone 6 Plus that I currently use for a 6 Plus or 6S Plus, I guess. 6 Plus S? 6S Plus.
Oh, I can't wait for the customers in my store to start butchering the names.
Yes. Ugh. I wish Apple would just... This should be the iPhone 7s. Forget about the S part. I understand that they kind of wait for the new number for when it's truly a different phone every 2 years. But, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, the TikTok approach works well for Apple in many respects. I understand why they do it. But... you know, it's funny. It is a lot of effort and a lot more effort than I think a lot of people or at least people that I affectionately call muggles. You know, the people who use this technology but don't necessarily live with the technology all the time. It's certainly a lot more for them to keep track of than I think they're really comfortable.
You know what this phone would be named if they didn't do that?
What?
This would be the iPhone 9.
Yeah, there you go. Actually, iPhone 10, right? Because
they had the first one, and then they had the 3.
The 3G.
Yep.
And then they had the 3GS.
Yep.
The 4, the 4S, the
5S, 6S.
Ah, you left out the 5C, which is a separate model.
Right. Well, but it came out at the same time as the 5S. So it's the same model year. So this should be the 9th iPhone.
I insist it's the 10th. and not to belabor the point, but there are actually technical differences under the hood between the 5, the 5S, and the 5S.
Yes, there is.
It is a distinct model. But 9 or 10, any way you slice it, there's a lot of darn iPhones out there.
There is a lot. And I own, other than the 5 and the 5S, or no, the 5 and the 5C, I have owned every one of them. Oh, I don't know what that says about me, Peter.
I think I'm more or less on the same track with you, except for the 5C. The 5C is the only one I've never owned.
I skipped the 5 completely. I was really happy with my 4S when I first got it. I got the white model, and it was just so fantastic. And I bought it late in the product cycle, so the 5 came out not too long after I bought my 4S. So I was like, I'm going to stick with this one. But then when the 5S came out, I had to jump on it.
Yeah, understandably. I mean, Siri was such a huge... Or no, the 5S... Yeah, the 5S was the touch ID, right?
Yes.
Right, okay. Right. Yeah, Siri was for the 4S.
Correct. And, you know, I was happy with my 5S. I almost didn't go with the 6 until I saw the 6 Plus. And then I had to touch it in person. And once I touched it, I had to have it. That was exactly the phone I've been waiting for. My 6 Plus is the best iPhone I've ever used.
You know, it's funny. And what's funny, Tim, is I know you. You know, we've known each other for a long time. You're not a particularly tiny person, but I have a working theory that hobbit-sized people are disproportionately attracted to the iPhone 6 Plus.
Well, I'm 6 foot.
Right, exactly. You're not a particularly small fellow, but...
Well, for me, it was if my thumb could reach the top of the screen without having to move my hand, and I can. I've got pretty large hands. So, bigger isn't necessarily always better. In fact, it's hardly ever better, to be honest. But in this case, that big of a screen, and I'm getting older, I have to wear reading glasses now, it just makes working with my phone so much better.
And I don't have anything close to the thumb reach that you do, because when I use a 6 Plus, I can't get my thumb anywhere near the top. I wear a medium-sized glove, which is funny because I'm 6'1". You know, I'm not a small person. But the thing that Apple did with the 6 and the 6 Plus both, which I thought was really smart, was this reachability function where you just double-tap the Touch ID and it brings the top half of the screen half a screen lower, so you can reach it more easily. That's made it a lot easier for me to use one-handed. And that was a real smart interface idea on Apple's part.
I forget that's there half the time because I never use it. Every now and then I'll accidentally activate it. Oh, well, what happened to my phone?
gee, I wonder why, Stretch. Can you palm a basketball too?
Yeah, I can actually.
There you go. That's why.
So the next thing for me was the one I was looking forward to the most, no question about it, and that's the new Apple TV. And Apple spent a lot of time in this presentation on the new Apple TV for good reason. This is, I think, potentially a game changer. Now, when it comes to television, Peter, I'm a little bit agnostic. I have an Amazon Fire Stick. I like it a lot. I'm a big user of Plex now. I think it's a superior in-house media center solution than Apple and iTunes is by far. And I can use it on my 360, my PS3, PS4. The only thing I can't really use it on, unfortunately, is my third generation Apple TV. So I like Plex because it allows me to find my content, my movies, a lot faster than the standard Apple TV, which I've always hated. You scroll forever and ugh. I think that the new Apple TV could change all that for me, Peter. This might be the device I've been waiting for.
What I appreciate the most about Apple TV, just as a consumer, a sort of a rabid consumer of television content. I mean, you know, the bariatric surgery that we were talking about before has helped me overcome one of my big vices, which is, you know, unhealthy food. But I certainly have some other vices. And one of them is I like watching a lot of episodic television. The one problem I've always had with the Apple TV is discoverability. And
oh, absolutely.
And its focus on making the channel information hierarchically more important than the content itself.
Yep.
And the fourth generation Apple TV that Apple showed off this week fixes that by making the content the important thing. You can lift your remote to your mouth and say, you know, Siri, I want to watch whatever show you want to watch, or a specific genre, or a general type of program, and it will pull up the matches for it, and it will show you in the channels where it's supported, where you can find that. So if you've got a Netflix subscription, you can pull it straight up on Netflix. If you've got a Hulu subscription, you can do that on Hulu. If you've got that content downloaded through iTunes or streamed through iTunes, you can do that as well.
HBO, Netflix, HBO and Hulu, and Showtime, and iTunes. Those are the five shipping when this comes out next month that
when this
support
comes out,
it.
Yeah. Exactly, and more to follow,
absolutely.
I am sure.
Oh, sure.
I'm a very avid watcher of Crunchyroll. Crunchyroll has been on the Apple TV for quite some time, and Crunchyroll provides access to Japanese animation or anime that hasn't been licensed for republishing and redistribution in the United States yet. So as an avid follower of anime ever since I was a kid, it gives me a way of staying up on many of the series that I watch. So that's one I subscribe to. That's one that's not going to be available at launch, but I'm really hoping that Crunchyroll comes on board with an Apple TV channel for the new device real soon. Now, having said all that, there are some shortcomings to the new Apple TV that I'm very unhappy about.
Shoot.
One thing that I noticed looking over the spec page that on Apple's website that compares the old Apple TV to the new Apple TV, it seems that the only way of getting Apple Music, at least right at launch, on the Apple TV is going to be to buy a new Apple TV. It doesn't say anything about Apple Music on the third generation Apple TV, and that worries me a lot. I hope we get some clarification from Apple there quickly.
I didn't notice that, and that would be definitely worrying, especially with the focus that they've put on Apple Music in the last 6 months, you would think. But then again, they're still going to be selling the Apple TV 3, so you would think that they would support it.
And here's another key difference. If you take a look at the capabilities of the two devices, Apple says that if you want to play music from your iTunes library, you need the third generation Apple TV. So Apple Music is accessible through the fourth generation Apple TV, and that's great. And Apple Music ostensibly should include your iTunes library, especially if you've started to download stuff from Apple Music as well. But if you want all the legacy stuff that you've collected up until now, it still seems like you need a third generation Apple TV hanging off the network someplace. So these are things that I'm sure that I don't want to cause too much consternation for anybody who's listening right now. These are, it's the morning after the announcement, and we're still assessing the lay of the land here. But those were a couple of things about the new Apple TV that jumped out at me.
I see that they're coming out in two models, 149 and 199. The only difference is 32 gigabytes and 64 gigabytes. I'm going to bite the bullet and get the $200 64 gigabyte. No question.
Oh, I don't think there's any question. And, the reason why you would want more onboard storage is because of all the great apps that you're going to be able to download, including in games. So that's exciting.
Do you think that this is a big threat to Microsoft, to Nintendo, to Sony, with Apple supporting games in the living room? I mean, look, the ecosystem in gaming on iOS has been amazing. Some of the best games and most played games, as far as I'm concerned, right now, for me, is on iOS. Now, some of that might be it's always with me, and I'm sitting there waiting at the school bus for my kids to get off, and I've got 10 minutes, so I'm going to play a game. But some of the games that are on iOS is so innovative. Crossy Roads comes to mind. And they did a demo of Crossy Roads on this Apple TV that looked amazing, made me want to go out and play Crossy Roads. Do you think gaming is a big threat to these companies and Apple really could take over there? Or do you think this is just another half-hearted attempt on Apple's part to get into gaming?
I don't think that that Sony and Microsoft are shaking in their – or Nintendo are shaking in their boots on day one. We've seen a sea change from Nintendo in the past couple of months, in that they used to be adamantly against developing apps for smartphones. And just yesterday, they announced the release in 2016 of Pokemon Go, a Pokemon game that's coming to smartphones. I have very little doubt that Nintendo is working very closely with Apple to make sure that Pokemon Go is playable on the Apple TV as well, and that's going to probably be a launch platform for them, because tvOS and iOS are so closely related. Having said all that, I think that, as we look further down the road, we'll have to take a wait-and-see approach to it. I think the old expression about how the proof of the pudding is in the eating comes to mind. We saw some great technology demos from Apple yesterday, but the fact of the matter is that we haven't really spent any length of time with the device itself to understand how it is as a gaming machine. What I do know is that just based on raw specs, based on the raw technical capabilities, there are a lot of limitations to Apple TV that will prevent PS4 or Xbox One-style games from coming to the platform. There's memory overhead. There's storage overhead. There's processing overhead. There are issues with other elements of the Apple TV box itself that will prevent many types of games and many middleware technologies from being used on the Apple TV. So I don't necessarily think that it's a blanket threat, but I do think that we are going to see a very different outcome with games on Apple TV than we did with the Pippin game console back in the 90s. That's right. That's right.
One of the first attempt. One of the worrying things for me, and I read this on a developer forum, is Apple is limiting apps on the Apple TV to 200 megabytes.
That's exactly right. That's one of the overhead issues that I'm talking about.
I don't understand. I do, because it's only 32 gigabyte, you have to assume that everyone's going to have the smallest one, so you have to accommodate that. But that's a big problem. I mean, some of these, not necessarily AAA titles, but AA or even A titles, are way over 200 megabytes currently on iOS. Grand Theft Auto is 1.2 gigabytes on my iPad.
And you'll notice that those apps, those games, were not demoed yesterday. The games that were demoed were more casual fare, more family-friendly fare, you know, stuff that can run in that overhead. So I think that stuff was left on the table for a reason. You know, Apple, I think the 200 megabyte limit may be a little bit arbitrary on Apple's part, and Apple may have to revisit that before too long. We'll see. If there's a legitimate technical reason why the 200 megabyte limit exists, that's a different story. But if it's just an arbitrary threshold that Apple came up with, at least to start, to roll out the first generation of Apple TV apps, that could be a smart thing.
Could be, but I have my doubts. It really does concern me. I wanted a device that will support the MiFi controller so I can use an Xbox 360-like steel case. Was it Steel Series controller? And I say that because I've got one sitting in front of me that I use on my iPad. Not very often, but I like that option.
Same, yeah. I've got a little one from... Steel Series as well, just a little pocket-sized one that I've used.
The white one?
It's black, but I think it's probably the same thing.
Oh, yeah, mine's black. Mine's white. I've got a white one, this mini one, and I've got the black Xbox 360-like controller from them.
Okay, yeah, I've got the white one, the black version of the white one that you've got, the one that just slips in your pocket and has two thumbsticks on it.
Yep, that's exactly it.
I would love to use it more than I do. I don't use it very often, unfortunately, so I would love to use it with my Apple TV. And of course, MFI controller support is baked into the new Apple TV. So if you've got – Yeah, absolutely. I can confirm that. So we ran an article on that on iMore, I think last night. So if you are using one of those controllers, then you're going to be in luck. You're going to be able to pair it with your Apple TV, you'll be able to benefit from it. And if you've been sitting on the fence about getting an MFI controller, maybe this is another excuse to take another look at what's out there.
What do you think about this remote that's coming with the Apple TV? It looks pretty impressive.
Yeah, I can't wait to see how quickly those glass trackpad areas on the top are going to get smashed by people.
Gotta wonder.
We'll see how durable they are, but it'll be very interesting to see how it actually works in practice. I have a Comcast remote that is voice controlled.
Yes, so do
I use the X1 service from Comcast, and a few weeks ago they sent me one of these special remotes that's got a microphone built into it, so you can say play Monday Night Football or whatever, and it will do it.
It's not great, though. It doesn't recognize a lot of content that I'm looking for, unfortunately.
You're absolutely right. So that's exactly where I was going with this, is that my experience with that has made me a little gun-shy about how effective using Siri on the TV is actually going to be. But my experience using Siri, especially when I'm out in the car, has changed so much over the course of the past year with iOS 8.
Oh, yeah.
Siri has really become an important part of my ability to communicate and my ability to navigate my world effectively and my ability to just, you know, work when I'm out. And even when I'm out for a run, I find myself amazed, you know, if I'm out for a walk or a run, and I get an important message from somebody from work or my wife or somebody who I need to respond to right away, I don't think anything about lifting the Apple Watch to my mouth and dictating a message and having it send flawlessly. Just the fact that I can do that and the fact that Siri is so well integrated into the iOS experience makes me very hopeful that Apple has gotten it right with the fourth generation Apple TV.
I didn't see this, but this is something that I would really, really like, is if they can somehow make it so the Apple TV can locate the remote for you. I'm so sick of losing remotes in my house, Peter.
I have to be honest with you, Tim. I'm really hoping, and we'll see, again, to go back to what I said before about the proof of the pudding is in the eating. We already have remote control support baked into the Apple Watch and a remote app that you can download for your iPhone or even your iPad. that lets you control the Apple TV remotely. I am going to be very interested to see how this translates into the new Apple TV, because honestly, Tim, I would just as soon lose that Apple TV remote in a drawer and do everything from my phone or my watch anyway.
And in some respects, I agree. I haven't used the actual Apple TV remote with my Apple TV in years. I use the iPhone app. It works perfectly. Unless I have to reset something, then you have to hunt down that original remote because you can't do it through the remote, the app remote. It's crazy.
It's the bane of every second generation Apple TV owner's existence.
Yep. Well, same thing with the Apple TV 3 as well.
Mm.
So I'm looking forward to it. This is one product I am definitely buying. A product that I don't know if I'm going to buy yet, I'm on the fence about, is the new iPad. It's 12.9, let's just call it basically a 13-inch screen. That's a big iPad.
It is a big iPad, but boy, is it powerful.
It's very, very powerful. I mean, it's almost on par with the new MacBook that just came out.
It really is. And I mean, having said that, the new MacBook is a little underpowered too. So
yeah.
There's something to be said there. But, you know, the new MacBook is a good showcase for what all MacBooks are going to look like in 2 or 3 years, right? If not function as it looked like. The new iPad Pro, for me, the thing that resonated the most is its use as a productivity device.
Yep.
What was Alan Greenspan's comment? I had irrational exuberance about the iPad Pro running Microsoft Office. I really like Microsoft Office on the iPad. I think that Microsoft, in many ways, does a better job with productivity workflow in Office on the iPad than Apple does with its iWork apps.
I don't think there's any question about it. I think when it comes to productivity software, no one is better than Microsoft. And they have really embraced not just the present of computing, but the future. I mean, they are way ahead of most people when it comes to this. And I think that it was very smart for Apple to invite them on stage to show, which was, quite honestly, a very impressive demo.
It really was. It was arguably the most impressive third-party demo that went up there yesterday. I was very, very impressed by that. The creative stuff, you know, using the Apple Pencil on the iPad Pro to draw or to illustrate or to design is not an area that really speaks to me as a user. It's not something that I really do with my devices that much. In the past, you know, I've gone through three distinct careers as a Mac guy in the past 30 years. One of them was tech support, another one was IT, and, you know, for the last 16 years, I've written full time. But when I did IT, I worked with graphic designers and illustrators and people in publishing. And I understand implicitly how important Apple devices are to these users and how intuitive using a device like an Apple Pencil is going to be on the iPad Pro, and I'm so happy for them. It's just not anything that I am using it for in particular. So just speaking purely for myself, the idea of using productivity software, whether it's the iWork apps or different software, third-party software like Evernote, for example, or Microsoft Office on an iPad Pro with a legitimate keyboard is pretty exciting. But I have to say that Apple introducing a smart keyboard didn't thrill me that much. And that's because both as an iPad user from day one and as somebody who sells these things on the weekends because I work for a third-party Apple reseller, I've never really been impressed with the quality or the fit of Apple's smart keyboards, I mean smart cases and smart covers for the iPad. They wear out very quickly. They look like crap. And quite frankly, they aren't the best design in the world either because Apple has put some whiz-bang technology into them, like magnetic spines that hold them onto the sides of the iPad. But the magnetic spines then cause the finish of the iPad to get scratched up over time as the cover shifts and move.
I completely agree with you. I haven't used an Apple-made cover for any of my iOS devices in years because they're not very good.
That's why I was very excited. Almost at the same time that Apple announced the iPad Pro, Logitech announced that it would offer a keyboard case for the new iPad Pro when that came out. So the third-party keyboards, I'm thrilled with. And I think the combination of the third-party keyboard and the pencil, wow. You know, talk about a powerful device to have in your hands. And that is going to be a good replacement for many people who otherwise might buy a MacBook or a MacBook Air.
And a lot of people are saying, yeah, but it's $99 for the pencil. If I want the keyboard, that's another $169. Man, that's going to be expensive. Why not just get a Mac? Well, here's the thing. If you are in the demographic that needs this pencil, you're a graphic designer. Well, I bet you already have a Wacom tablet. I mean, those things are not cheap.
That's exactly right. First of all, there is the existing economy to think about and to understand what the cost of entry is for a Mac user. And people have been doing legitimate illustration and design work on iPads for many years with third-party devices like the Jot Stylus, for example, the pencil or pencil from 53, you know, an incredible, incredible tool.
To a certain extent, but the liability or the limited pressure sensitivity of all iPads up until now has really prevented serious, serious work to get done.
I don't think that that's true. I think that people have worked around the shortcomings of the technology. But having said that, Apple's addition of pressure sensitivity to the iPad Pro and the introduction of the Apple Pencil obviously opens up new venues that we never could have dreamed of yesterday. So that stuff is very exciting. That stuff is very exciting indeed. I don't think that the iPad Pro is going to, you know, I had a reader yesterday mention to me that he had read a number of articles on the internet yesterday that it said that the Mac is doomed because of the iPad Pro. Well, I think that that's just ridiculous. I think anybody who says that is either pandering to hysteria or is just not thinking it through. The Mac and the iPad, even with the iPad Pro on the scene now, the Mac and the iPad have very different use cases. They're very different devices. Where I could see myself using an iPad Pro is on plane trips. Instead of having to haul out a MacBook or a MacBook Air in my little coach seat, you know, just being able to drop the tray table, open up an iPad Pro with a keyboard and start working. And hey, guess what? Microsoft's been doing it with the Surface for now. And Microsoft has actually been picking up a fair amount of traction with the Surface. The Surface 3 is an excellent device.
Absolutely.
You know, if you've never sat down and used one, listener, I strongly encourage you to get yourself to a Microsoft store or wherever else you can find one and get some hang time with it, because they're really elegant, well-designed devices.
I know a lot of graphic designers who went to the Surface Pro because it has a pressure-sensitive screen. They needed that. And I think the iPad Pro 2 or iPad Pro is going to kind of bring them back to the iPad family. I mean, they're Apple users at heart. They always have been.
I think Apple's going to sell a lot of iPad Pros. Absolutely.
It's not inexpensive. And to me, that's $799 for the base 32-gigabyte model, $949 for the 128-gigabyte, or if you add cellular data, it's another $130, so $1,079. All of these price points, though, Peter, is right in the MacBook Air range.
Yeah, but that's nothing new. I mean, you know, the high-end iPads have always scraped MacBook levels. And, you know, the 11-inch MacBook Air has been around for a few years, and Apple recently lowered the price to $899, which put it in high-end iPad territory. That didn't seem to affect the sales of either high-end iPads or of the 11-inch MacBook Air. The bottom line is the Mac and this is what I tell my customers all the time when they come in the store. The Mac and the iPad are fundamentally different devices. They allow you to interact with data in different ways. They allow you to interact with the internet in different ways. And they're different use experiences, because one runs iOS and runs all the apps that you can download from the iOS App Store, and the other one runs OS X and then runs all the apps that you can run from the Mac App Store. These apps are designed to work with very different interfaces. You know, one is touch-based. The other one is cursor-based and trackpad-based. And you know, it's a very different usage experience. So I'm not worried about one bumping up against the other. I think that the iPad Pro will find its market. And that market, there may be some cannibalization from people who otherwise might buy Macs, but Apple's attitude towards that is we don't really care as long as they're buying Apple products.
Well, they've got a history of cannibalizing their own products for a better product. And, you know, they did the same thing back in the iPod days. They retire their most popular iPod for a replacement, and they have no problem doing that. And as someone who less than a year ago picked up an iPad Air 2, and I love it, by the way. It's a fantastic iPad. It's the best iPad I've ever had. I don't know if I'm going to replace it with the iPad Pro because it doesn't fit what I need it to do. I need a laptop when I'm on the road, and if I'm not using my laptop, I'm using my iPad Air. So for me personally, I think I'm going to stick with my iPad Air for a while. Plus, this thing's so big, I can't imagine sitting on the couch with this huge iPad. Just too big for me.
You know, it's interesting. I obviously am not going to buy anything right away. I really want to get my hands on the new gear, either at an Apple store or somewhere else, and try to, you know, get a better sense of how this fits into my lifestyle and how this fits into my workflow as well. But the iPad Pro is the first iPad I've seen, arguably since the first generation iPad, where I really stopped and said, wow, that thing has so much new capability and so much new functionality. That could really be a game changer for me.
Apple claimed that it's faster than 80% of the portable PCs shipped in the last 12 months, which is true, but let's be honest, most of the portable PCs sold in the last 12 months have been junky, underpowered computers. They're not great computers to begin with.
Well, yeah. It's
and we've all seen them, too. I mean, you see them when you go into a Best Buy. You see them when you're at a coffee shop. These people are using these little cheap Dells or EMPC, stuff you've never even heard of that's probably on sale at Target or Walmart or something for $149, and they're junk.
That's exactly right.
Do you think the iPad at all is kind of aimed at that Chromebook user?
I think so. I think that it's aimed squarely at not just Chromebook users, but school systems and enterprises that might have been considering Chromebooks instead, for sure.
That's the interesting thing you just said was education. You know, I ran an Apple store for 3.5 years, and we saw a big shift towards the end of my time there of school districts going from MacBooks, the white MacBooks, to Chromebooks because of the ecosystem, because of the price, because of the durability. And if you broke one, not such a big deal. It's just a cheap little Chromebook. The iPad Air, on the other hand, is not just a cheap little thing. I have to imagine that the educational pricing will be a lot lower, so Apple could start making headway in there. But I think this would be a compelling purchase for a school district that's looking to buy a lot of these and deploy them throughout a school.
Yeah, well, we'll see. I mean, you know, historically, Apple's educational pricing, in recent history anyway, hasn't really been that aggressive.
No.
You know, so I wouldn't expect that you'll be able to, you know, as an educational institution, even buying in quantity, I don't think that you're going to be able to get an iPad Pro for, let's say, $400 or $500. It's going to be more than that. But having said that, I think that there's certainly a place for them in some circumstances, especially in higher ed. I would anticipate that more than K-12. You're right. You know, and I've seen the same trend working in retail, where, you know, we get parents every August who say, "Yeah, my son or my daughter is starting a new school." And they need an iPad. An iPad is a prerequisite. Conversely, you know, my 15-year-old goes to public school. He just came home with a Chromebook 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, that's because what they use in my kids' school district.
And that's fine. You know, I would rather, you know, as a lifelong Apple user, I would rather that my 15-year-old be platform agnostic. And indeed, he really is. He's used a Mac before. He had a Mac for a number of years, but he uses a Windows phone, and he and I built his own PC for his birthday. So, mm-hmm. You know, the kids these days, I think, need better fluidity and better fluency when it comes to different platforms. He's happy with the Chromebook because the school has standardized on Google Docs for their workflow, and that's how they've trained the teachers. So the teachers distribute assignments over Google Docs. They expect homework through Google Docs. He's able to stay on top of what he's doing a lot more. I can't fault either Google or Apple for how they manage these relationships with school. The bottom line is each school district is going to find their own path to do it, and Apple is either has a seat at the table or it doesn't. But some school districts certainly prefer the Chromebook stuff. Some school districts prefer the iPad stuff.
I tell you, it's the Chromebooks are a very competitive product, and what I like about it is that if my daughter doesn't have her Chromebook at home, she gets to jump on one of my laptops, log into her Google account, and there's all the data right there. And it works flawlessly right in the web browser.
That's exactly right.
So it's a competitive product that Google has put out there for education. And I hope Apple gets a little bit more competitive in it. I think this iPad Pro could really be a game changer if they get a little bit more aggressive on price and education. The last thing, of course, is the thing I had the least amount of interest in, to be honest with you, Peter. It's the Apple Watch.
You know, I am a little ambivalent about rose gold. rose gold, by the way, isn't just unique to the Apple Watch.
No.
Rose gold is the new finish for 2015. And, you know, Apple has a rose gold iPhone available, iPhone 6S, iPhone 6 Plus, and I think rose gold iPad as well,
no,
right?
No.
No? No rose gold iPad this year?
No rose gold, no.
Okay, so scratch that. But I am surprised, pleasantly surprised, actually, with the reaction both from men and women in social media that I'm connected to at how excited they are about rose gold. This is apparently a finish that's very popular in fashion jewelry right now. It's something that people think is smart and timely and on trend for Apple to do. So that's great. One thing I will say about the new finishes and the new bands for the Apple Watch, I'm very, very excited about getting a red sport band for my Apple Watch.
That looked really cool, I will say.
Here's the thing. I rock the Mickey Mouse face on my Apple Watch. I when I first got my Apple Watch in June, I went through the different faces and, you know, oh, this one's pretty. Oh, this one's interesting. And then I saw the Mickey Mouse one, and immediately I was 4 years old again. My first watch, the first watch that I ever got from my mother and my grandparents, was a Mickey Mouse watch, a TikTok mechanical wind-up watch that had a red leather band on it, and I wore it every day, and I wore that band out. That band fell apart on my wrist. And I would hold the watch up to my ear for hours to listen to the TikTok sound because I was so fascinated with the mechanical sound of that. Now, I don't get the TikTok sound out of my Apple Watch anymore, but Mickey is there tapping his little feet in time with the counting of seconds. And it makes me very happy to see him. But the only problem is I haven't been able to get a red band from Apple. I've been able to get third-party red bands, but they really haven't suited my aesthetic or what I'm looking for. So the availability of the red band from Apple, the sports band, that'll probably be the first band that I purchased for my watch distinctly from the one that it came with.
It's very cool looking. When I saw that red band on that black watch, that I gotta say that I don't understand why Apple doesn't go more with these bold colors on some of their products, but that really kind of popped to me.
Yeah, a joke I made on Twitter yesterday was that Apple is doomed because there's no purple iPhone.
I actually replied to that, and I said, actually, all you have to do is get a newer case, KX case, and put it on there, and it's purple.
There you go. Actually, that's a great point. If I know anybody over at Newer, I should ask for one.
Absolutely, we'll get you one.
Actually, not only that, but you know, there are for people who are really interested, and if customization is really your thing, you can actually have your Apple Watch or your iPhone or your iPad anodized with a custom color. It costs a lot of money to do, but if you really want a unique looking device, you can send out your device and have it done. But it is a pricey embellishment, and much safer to put an NX case or another durable case on your device and keep it safe, because that helps improve the resale value when these new devices are refreshed. So you make more money selling your old device and buying a new one.
You know, this was, if you include the musical act at the end, which I didn't stick around to watch, a 2-hour and 20-minute presentation. It was a little over 2 hours for just the meat of the show. That's a movie. And a lot of people are complaining, even though it wasn't one of the longest Apple events I've ever watched. But still, that was a long event. Are you surprised that it was one event and that they didn't split the iPad stuff into another event and maybe even include any new Macs coming up for next month? My understanding is this is the one event at the end of the year, and that's it for Apple.
Yeah, I think that if we do get any more Macs, it's going to be
press release.
Yeah, press release. It's going to be a stealth update, as we like to say. And I wasn't expecting any movement on Macs yesterday, for sure. Although it wouldn't surprise me if Apple does some kind of refresh before the end of the year, because the iMac and the Mac Pro are both looking really long in the tooth. So that would be nice. As far as the length of it is concerned, I thought it was excruciating. I would like to see these things down to an hour.
Me too.
Whether that means Apple does these as two separate events or just figures out a way to consolidate, I felt like there was a lot of fluff during this presentation.
Oh, when that lady came on to demonstrate shopping on the Apple TV, it just sucked all the air right out of everybody. It was so boring and so drawn out. She was so bad. People were like, oh, let's keep going. This is terrible.
Look, guilt, you know, is certainly appeals to a certain class of customer.
Yeah, but
and
not who's
fantastic.
Watching the keynote.
But yeah, arguably that was a miss. Eddie Q seemed to get really excited about it, but whatever.
It's his job.
Yeah, exactly. It's his job. So, I thought that certain parts of it dragged on for too long, and Apple didn't necessarily need to. I'm not going to call out anybody by name, but Apple didn't need all the third parties that were up on stage showing the stuff off. I think to be perfectly frank, Apple's at its strongest when it's speaking on behalf of its own products, not letting third parties do it for them. That's always where these things slow down.
I don't know. I think Microsoft being up there showing their demo on the iPad Pro as well as Adobe, I think those were really big things for a lot of people. I would say
those were needed, as well as
the Crossy Roads thing for the Apple TV. They needed to demo a game on this thing.
Microsoft is and you heard me before. I think that Microsoft's productivity stuff is actually better than Apple's. Mm-hmm. But in the context of doing that demo, I think Apple would have had just as strong a message showing the iPad Pro showing off Apple apps with the iPad Pro.
It's kind of surprising that they didn't show any Apple apps on this device, on pretty much any of these things.
Yeah, exactly, which, you know, is something that maybe I'm sort of falling down the rabbit hole thinking about now, you know, talking about now. But my point is these, two hours and 20 minutes, that's just an excruciating length of time for a lot of people. It went on too long. Apple's got to find a way to edit it and cut it down a little bit and make it shorter.
Let's change focus here at the end and talk about product that, a report just came out, Peter, that the top 10 flashlight apps for Android are all malware. They're all capturing data on these phones and sending them off to who knows where. And I like to point out to people when I read these reports and I see people commenting on them, is just to buy an iPhone. There's a lot of, and there has been for a long time, people who come down on either, no, we need openness, or no, we need some curated content. We need someone making sure that everything's kosher before we download it. And when I read reports like this, Boy, I'm glad I'm an iPhone user, not an Android user.
Well, you know, there is a certain contingent of user out there who feels that Apple's walled garden approach is counterproductive and is not keeping with their philosophy, and they're certainly entitled to that opinion. But the fact of the matter is that every time you open up your device to these different ecosystems, you run the risk of some kind of problem. And I mean, the same thing exists on the iPhone for people who jailbreak, right? There was just a report last week about how several hundred thousand iCloud accounts were compromised using malware that was designed to exploit issues on jailbroken iPhones. Obviously, the problem with malware infection is a lot more widespread on Android than it is on Apple. But like or lump the walled garden approach, you can't argue that Apple's been able to keep a lot of that problem at bay by keeping a much tighter control over the third-party app ecosystem than Google has with Android.
Yeah. It's scary. And for those who are using Android, just be careful. Unfortunately, there's a lot of bad people out there who want your data, and be careful.
You know, I look at it this way. Be like Reagan in Reykjavik. Trust but verify.
There you go. I like that a lot. So, Peter, once again, thanks for being here on the 50th episode of OWC Radio. Where can people find your writing, what you're doing online now?
Very honored to be here. Thank you very much for having me, Tim, on number 50, and congratulations on getting to the half-century mark.
There you go. It's a fun show to do.
You can find my writing at imore.com. I also do freelance work for macworld.com, Macformat Magazine, MacLife, Tom's Hardware. So you can find my stuff all over the web. Best way to get a hold of me, if you've got any questions or want to talk or whatever, is on the social things. Twitter is where I spend a lot of my day. And if you're on Twitter, you can find me at Flarg, F-L-A-R-G-H.
And we'll put a link in the show notes to Peter's Twitter account so you can find him. Of course, I follow Peter on Twitter. He's, if nothing else, entertaining. And at the end of the day, Peter, that's what I'm looking for. I want to be entertained.
Oh, well, thank you very much. We aims to please.
To please. All right. With that, we're going to wrap up this episode of OWC Radio. Make sure you go to macsales.com for all your Apple-related needs. Need a new hard drive? OWC. Need new RAM? Need a new iPhone case? We've got you covered. Macsales.com. And, of course, blog.macsales.com. You'll find show notes for OWC Radio, great content posted daily. And in fact, if you want to find out about the big sales going on at OWC, make sure you sign up to our newsletter. You'll find a link at the top of the page at macsales.com. Follow us on Twitter, follow us on Facebook, and we'll see you in about a week.